Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. In a word, the Trump-Xi summit was a nothing burger. It was an historic visit that will be quickly forgotten. What will be remembered is China's Thucydides trap warning. Also, how has security in the Persian Gulf changed since the war of choice against Iran? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He's an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's kick it off with Mark. Mark, we had the summit. Trump went to China. None of us really expected anything except for a photo op. It was very festive. The Chinese are very hospitable. Lots of children with waving flags and all of this here. And as I said in my introduction, it was historic, but will be easily forgotten, except for one thing. And I think all three of us perked up immediately when the Thucydides trap was mentioned, and it was mentioned as a warning. What is it, Mark, and why is it important?
Okay, so this was a warning, perhaps even a threat from the Chinese president directly to the American president in public. So the Thucydides trap in relation to Russia and China, it is the analysis of the ancient Greek political philosopher Thucydides that when you have a situation with a fading hegemon and a rising power, that conflict is inevitable. Now, in reality, it's a little more complicated than that, but that's what it is boiled down to, right? At the 101 level, and that really, that's, you know, the best level we can expect from President Trump understanding. And this has been talked about in Western academic and international relations cycles on the front pages, magazines for two decades now in relation to the U.S. and China. However, to have it come directly from the Chinese president's mouth to the American president's mouth is an entirely new situation. And evidently someone explained to Trump what he was talking about, because before he had even left Beijing, Trump was, on his phone typing away, addressing the idea, although it was said implicitly rather than explicitly, that the Chinese president was saying that the U.S. is a fading power and China is the rising power. And Trump tried to blow it off with the, he was talking about under Biden. Joe Biden, not me, because we're in a golden age, blah, blah, blah. But basically, by doing this, what he was implicitly admitting in his kowtowing to the Chinese president and trying to excuse him, right, is that the situation is exactly that. Although I think more than anything, what this summit proved is that China's military, economic, and diplomatic power has already eclipsed that of the
U.S. Well, that's one of the first things I drew going to George now. I mean, Trump met a peer. He met an equal, and it was actually presented as such. But what was interesting to me beyond the Thucydides trap is that she made it very clear what he's interested in. He's not interested in Trump's problems with Iran, okay, number one, okay? What he's interested in is Taiwan. And that is the most important issue. This is what coming from the Chinese president, important issue embedded in the Chinese-Russia relationship. He made sure Trump got that message. Go ahead, George.
Well, Trump did get the message. And in fact, Trump's subsequent interviews with Sean Hannity and with Brett Baer indicated that he really wasn't very interested in Taiwan. And in fact, he actually said, hey, Taiwan has been stealing our superconductors. And we're not going to go, fight a war 9,000 miles away. So he indicated that he really wasn't very interested. So the issue of
not Taiwan very ambiguous. Not very ambiguous.
But he maintained at least the strategic ambiguity that had been the norm up until Biden, who several times said that any Chinese move against Taiwan would be a casus belli for the United States. It was Biden who departed from the diplomatic norm. Trump restored the norm and, in fact, spoke disparagingly about Taiwan. You know, they stole superconductors and indeed indicated that he may not go through with the arms sales. I mean, he probably will, but he indicated that he's having second thoughts about it. Now, the problem, though, about the Thucydides trap is, after all, in the history of the Peloponnesian War was Sparta won that war. So, yes, it was the war was triggered by the rise of Athens and the fear this induced in Sparta, but Sparta prevailed. And if we think of other instances of the Thucydides trap, Germany, the rising power at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, Britain, the fading power, Britain prevailed. So, when you know, one has to think in those terms. I mean, that, hey, you know, the declining hegemon could easily prevail. And I'm sure when we talk about China's military power and the U.S. military power, well, the United States has formal military alliances with 51 states around the world. It's a network of military alliances, intelligence, security arrangements. It has military bases, 750 of them around the world. China has one formal military ally, North Korea. China has one military base outside
but
China.
So to say that
China has eclipsed the United States is premature.
Well, first of all, the Thucydides trap is not about who wins. It's all about the propensity of war, okay? It's not who wins, okay? Number two, all of those bases I would posit now after the defeat in Iran is that they are liabilities to the United States, and the client states that have them know it. Mark.
Yeah, this grand network of American alliances, vassal states, clients, and proxies around the world can't even beat a regional power like Iran into submission. Instead, Iran has emerged as, according to the New York Times, as the fourth, not me, the New York Times, as the fourth greatest power in the world. The fact is that the U.S. military industrial complex is no longer industrial to scale. Their industrial potential has been farmed out to the rest of the world. China controls the refinement of rare earths on which all modern technological semiconductor chips, high-end components for the missiles and drones that modern wars must be fought are controlled by China. China has 232 times the shipbuilding capacity of the United States.
Indian Pacific Ocean.
Any war between the U.S. and China is not going to be fought in Hawaii. It is going to be fought off of the Chinese coast, because it is the U.S. that is the fading hegemon that is attempting to contain and pressure China in its own backyard. The missile gap between China and the U.S. was something that was already identified a decade ago for that conflict, and the U.S. just emptied their entire cupboard raining down missiles ineffectively on top of Iranian granite mountains.
You know, George, what was interesting is that while Xi was very cordial, that's always to be expected, he basically said to Trump, your problems are your problems, okay? Well, we can manage our bilateral relationship, but, you know, you walked into this, that these are things that you wanted and you're going to have to deal with. She didn't give him any help whatsoever, George.
Well, he didn't give him any help. But on the other hand, I mean, if we just look at where the situation was, I mean, the United States has taken Venezuela off the chessboard. Venezuela was an important ally of China's. China was receiving oil from Venezuela. It's now receiving zero oil from Venezuela. Now there is Iran. That's a major source of oil for China. But just think of what the United States did. February the 28th, the United States launched an onslaught against Iran. It hasn't succeeded. However, had it succeeded, China would have been really up against it. I mean, that's a serious blow to China. You can't be a global power, the number one global power, if you are that vulnerable. And that's the case. If China is to be, you know, the reigning hegemon, I'm afraid it has to do a lot more than what it's doing now. It's going to have to form a strategic military alliance with Russia. Only Russia and China together can rival the United States. If that happened, then I think that the world balance could change. But China on its own, Russia on its own, I don't think they can take
well, on. I don't know if that's
a network of military allies, military, economic, financial power of the world.
Yeah, but Mark, for all the talk about the Strait of Hormuz being closed, it's open for China.
Yeah, I mean, Trump says, you know, you can agree with us that you want the Strait of Hormuz open to receive oil. And China's like, yes, we're still getting oil. That's not a problem. And if you try to stop our oil getting to us, then we might have some words, right? And it is a matter of the independent tracker's fact that these oil tankers on their way to China are not stopped or attempted to be stopped by the United States. And of course, there's a reason for that. Russia and China, first of all, have, in effect, a strategic alliance, right? It's not called that, but the relationship between Russia and China is looking a lot better these days than, let's say, the special relationship between the U.S. and the United Kingdom.
Well, I mean, Putin is on his way to China next week or this week.
Putin is on his way so that they can huddle and discuss exactly what Trump said to Xi Jinping. Third of all, Russia and China are not trying to be the next hegemon. That is not a goal of theirs. Their goal is not to project power off the U.S. coast. Their goal is the birth of a multipolar world. They are not looking to dominate the world in the same way that the U.S. and its proxies has for the last few decades. That makes all the difference in the world.
You know, George, you know, the Trump came back saying the same thing that he said before, that Iran must not have a nuclear weapon. But ultimately, because of this war of choice, eventually Iran will have one.
Well, if it's capable of doing so. But one would think that if China, or a bit rather Iran, were to move towards developing nuclear weapons, it would indeed come under yet another massive attack, which in fact could happen anytime in the coming days. So to move towards it, I you know, it's hard to know how close they are to nuclear weapons.
What I'm just saying.
At the moment, it seems like this nuclear material is buried deep underground, but maybe they have other sources that they have.
My point was something different, is that because of the demand that Iran not do that, eventually that is going to be the outcome for its own self-defense and deterrence.
I agree.
Counterproductive, this whole thing.
Yeah. If they can
gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. You know the rules, hard break. And when we come back, we'll discuss some more hard news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. To mind you, we're discussing some real news. Let's go back to Mark here. Mark, one of the things I found very interesting, we were in the first part of the program, we were talking about the summit, the American-Chinese summit in Beijing. And of course, we're all avid followers of what's going on in Ukraine. And now I'm going to connect the third dot, is that we have players such as Saudi Arabia and Qatar coming out and using new security architecture, which is part and parcel of what this program is all about, and it has been for years. This is part of the multipolar world that you were talking about on the first part of the program. You have to go to the core issues actually being brought up again, too. And all of these conflicts here, the core issues need to be addressed for a new security architecture, because the old one, NATO, the Gulf, the American umbrella in the Persian Gulf, they have failed. Mark.
Yeah, not only has, the U.S. security umbrella in the Middle East failed, but you could argue that it has dragged these Arab countries into a fight that they did not necessarily want and made them more vulnerable. In fact, those U.S. military bases haven't done the U.S. any good in the conflict with Iran. Instead, they just presented a target so that Iran could actually hit the United States, with U.S. troops cowering in civilian hotels off of their bases, working remotely, as it said. By the way, war crime when you're hiding among civilians by that. But, you know, we'll let that one slide, I guess. But security as a whole, and really the whole framework of hegemony, that the U.S. and Israel and Saudi Arabia through this tripod have upheld in the Middle East for many decades, for going on 50 years now, is fraying and coming to an end. And I mean, it's really no surprise that there's not exactly any unity among the Gulf Arab states about what is to come forward, you know, after the conflict, the war on Iran is over, with an Iran newly dominant and assertive over the Middle East, as likely seems the case. And we have two very different directions. The UAE is clinging ever closer to the skirts of the United States and Israel.
Israel, right.
And pushing both of them to continue the conflict against Iran, with the UAE pulling out of OPEC and so forth. They were trying to get the Arab states to unify together and join the U.S. and Israel in attacking in Iran. They failed to do that. Saudi Arabia, meanwhile, is sitting back from all of this and saying, yeah, that multi-vector foreign policy is looking really good right now. And, you know, when the Iranians are talking about security architecture for the region, we could get on board with that if it protects our ability to export oil. So a more pragmatic relationship.
But that means coming to some kind of understanding with Iran, George, and that's what it's really all about. Of course, there's always the issue of Israel, which can it's ever present, and it can be ever problematic, particularly if the United States pursues a separate foreign policy, which we haven't seen to date. But I think we could, I mean, pragmatically, and that's why it's so hard to understand current American foreign policy, because there's no common sense to it. It's not very pragmatic. But there's going to be a choice for these monarchies: come to terms with Iran or continue down the path with the Americans and the Israelis. Well, it doesn't seem like a very commonsensical choice to me. I mean, it's obvious. Go ahead.
Well, I think they want to keep a foot in both camps. And after all, Saudi Arabia has also joined in the U.S. attacks on Iran. And now Saudi Arabia's case is a little different from the UAE's. I mean, UAE is absolutely now aligned with the United States. And Israel's left OPEC. You know, of course, it joined the Abraham Accords. Saudi Arabia hasn't done that. But I don't think that the United States is leaving the Persian Gulf for very obvious reasons. These Gulf kingdoms are themselves wholly dependent upon the United States. So even if the worst came to the worst, and let's say for the United States, and Saudi Arabia started demanding that the United States will withdraw, the United States would not withdraw, just like the United States has not withdrawn from Iraq, despite the Iraqi parliament's demand that the United States withdraw. And I think I don't think the Gulf kingdoms really will push very hard for U.S. withdrawal, because, you know, they want to have, you know, they do want to maintain civil relations with Iran, but, you know, they want to keep a foot in both camps. So I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think the United States is going to withdraw. And as I say, even if they went all the way to demanding U.S. withdrawal, the United States wouldn't withdraw. They say, no, we're staying put. What are you going to do about it? And of course, there's nothing they can do about it.
Well, remarkably, it looks like Mark is agreeing with you. Explain yourself, Mark.
Well, I'm agreeing with to an extent. Certainly, Iran could do something about it. They could keep the Strait of Hormuz closed and make the global economy scream until the U.S. agrees. They could launch more missiles and drones and destroy the U.S. bases all over again, which they've already done to a degree that the New York Times and CNN and everyone else keeps assessing up and up with the amount of damage that they have done, with absolutely zero effective air defense capacity by the United States. So they can certainly do something about it. But I do agree that the U.S. is not going to completely withdraw from the Middle East. However, I think that a lot of these bases that have been heavily pummeled closest to Iran, right, and in countries that, you know, may want to somewhat reassess, you know, pursue a more multi-vector foreign policy without completely abandoning the security relationship with the U.S. We'll see the U.S. never reopen some of these military bases. Why? They're vulnerable. I mean, the cost, you know, and the vulnerability, I think that's going to happen. But it's also true, as George said, that the U.S., the power that Iran has is not enough to completely force the U.S. to withdraw from the Middle East. That's a pipe dream. And ultimately, you know, for the Arab countries, their militaries are already locked in and completely reliant on the United States. It would take them decades to convert their militaries over to other suppliers. Although it is worthy of note, a rather interesting caveat, one thing that we learned in the Trump-China summit is that China provided weapons to the Gulf states in the midst of this conflict.
Well, that's news to me. I didn't catch that, okay? Well, I will follow up on that there. George, you know, all of us talking about the state of the conflict in the Middle East against Iran. I can remember very clearly as Trump's trip to Beijing approach, we say, hey, he probably won't do it there, you know, because, and he won't do it when he's there. But now he's gone here. There's still an enormous amount of pressure on him to take more military action. Towards what end? I'm mystified by that. But that is still an option. And considering he's in a deadlock position, he doesn't really know which way to go forward. It seems to me his tendency is to double down. What do you think is going to happen in the next few days?
I think that's where it's looking. Just going by the story a few days ago in the New York Times, which suggested that they're drawing up plans for another onslaught. But you're right. In the question is, to what end? Is it in order to force Iranian surrender, which they've tried and haven't succeeded, or is it in order to get some kind of a final deal, saying, "Hey, we went out, you know, with all guns blazing. This isn't any. We're not wimping out. We show how tough we are." And then sort of when the final agreement is signed, you say, well, yeah, that was after we really applied serious force. So maybe a prelude to some kind of a deal. But otherwise, his options are indeed running out.
What do you think, Mark?
Yeah, no good options. We've discussed this before. He can't take the L. He can't take. He can't accept the Iranians' terms in control of the Strait of Hormuz. He can't walk away and declare victory. So they'll double down on what the U.S. always done: drop some bombs, kill some more leaders, and hope Black Swan that something comes better on the other end. It won't, of course. And the end result: there will be no deal. There's not going to be any signed deal with this anymore. There will be in Ukraine. The U.S. will make some noises and thump their chests and limp away. Iran and Oman will be in control of the Strait of Hormuz, and the region will remain tense with everything unresolved. And we'll see another such conflict sometime in the next 5 years reignite.
Meanwhile, I agree with you, Mark, completely. There's going to be no deal. How will we move forward? I don't know. I mean, I don't think anyone's crystal ball is clear enough to see that. But George, meanwhile, the global economy is being walloped. Okay, I mean, I'm informed by friends living in the States. I asked them, what's your gas price? $7, $7.80, $8. Okay. That's unsustainable.
It is unsustainable. And I agree with Mark. I don't think there will be a deal. And I think this is just going to be a festering sore Obviously, huge problem, you know, for the global economy. There's some people that are making money. I think the oil majors in the United States are making money. And I think, you know, those they're Trump's friends. Trump is very happy to see them making money. But it's going to be a sore point in the United States. And when the next presidential election campaign begins, which is in a few months' time, this is going to be a central issue, which is, what are we going to do about Iran? Iran is our major geostrategic problem. We need to do something about it, much as Iraq became a kind of a big political football throughout the 1990s over the inconclusive conclusion of Gulf War I. So I think, yeah, that this is going to go on and the Americans are going to come back, whether under Trump or whoever comes after Trump, they're going to come back and try to hit Iran all over again.
1 minute, Mark.
It's really interesting that we bring up Iraq again, because Iraq has been the battleground. And actually, the battle is still being waged in Iraq, right? Israel built a secret air base there, supposedly secret. And pro-Iranian groups in Iraq continue to hit the U.S.-aligned Kurds in the Kurdish region. A final battle between the U.S. and Iran for the region is not going to happen now. But when it does happen, it's going to be fought largely in Iraq. And the future makeup of Iraq, probably a divided country going forward, is going to be the final result of that.
Absolutely fascinating. I've always thought we should change the name of this program to Unintended Consequences, because that's what we have here. Okay, I want to thank my guests in Budapest and here in Moscow. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, Crosstalk rules.